my go-to fault guy. Well, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Finally. It's good to see everybody. Hopefully the rest of what I'm going to do goes a little bit smoother than all of that. This year we're talking about faith, and we've been in Hebrews 11 and 12 and last week 13. But we're going to take a break from that today. I've got some things that I've been thinking about that I have finally kind of got together, I think, in my thinking, in such a way that I can share them, kind of the teaching capacity. And it's interesting how all of that has worked out time-wise. This week, just to share some good news with all of you, this week, if you didn't know this, let me back up a little bit. If you didn't know this, when Calvin moved here, I don't remember even how this happened, Calvin. I'm probably going to say this wrong, but I think Calvin came to me and said, hey, I want to do a study at UCSC where he was going to school. And I said, that's great. And he said, you know, would you be interested in, like, coming along? And I think he just wanted me to come, but then I ended up, like, kind of taking over. I don't think that was his intention, but that's kind of what I did. And so I went and met a bunch of people that he had invited to come to this study. And we've had that, I don't know how long it's been going, but a while. Almost 2 years? Has it been that long? Wow, man. So at the very first study, there was a group of people, and one of those people was a guy named Ryan. And I had asked Calvin ahead of time, like, this story's going too long, I'm sorry. I'd asked Calvin ahead of time, like, tell me about these people. And so he kind of told me about everybody, what everybody was majoring in, what he knew about them. And when he told me about Ryan was the one I was scared of, actually, kind of intimidated by. Ryan is some sort of, like, science major, and I don't even understand what it is that he's studying. It's, like, one of those type of majors. And Ryan's head is about this big. It's, like, that large, and it's not – I don't mean that metaphorically. I mean that, like, literally. He's got a lot of brain matter, and he's a brilliant guy. And I was intimidated by him, and I thought for sure – and I told Calvin this before. I thought for sure, man, I know what this guy's here for. I know what he's here for. I know this is going to turn into one of those – well, what about science? And what about, you know, what about this thing that I learned? What about that thing I learned? And kind of putting me in the hot seat. And I was nervous about that, as any of us are anytime that happens to us. And I found out very quickly, and I've told Calvin this a bunch of times, I have absolutely no ability in reading people. Like, I thought that's what it was going to be, and it was the exact opposite. I tell you all that because now, after almost 2 years of studying, on Thursday, after our study, Ryan gave himself to Christ in baptism. So that's incredible news. And Ryan has been quickly moving in that direction. Well, it's 2 years, but you may not think that's quickly, but with where Ryan came from, I think it is quickly. And it is extremely encouraging to see Ryan give his life to the Lord. He has been kind of progressively doing that. But he, I guess, in a sense, finalized that decision in baptism on Thursday. And so I wanted to share that with you. And that's not disconnected from what I'm going to talk about this morning. There's a reason I told you that story. I want to start by reading a text out of John chapter 4. So go ahead and get your Bibles out and get there. And I'll kind of introduce why I'm talking about this. I was asked a while ago by a congregation up in the San Jose area to come up and do one of several lessons that I'll be doing up there out of John chapter 4. And so they told me that a long time ago, and so I've been thinking about this text. And then some other things have been happening in studies that I've been happening with folks that are not Christians. One of those includes the one with Ryan. And some other texts have come up in those studies that have been on my mind. And all of this just kind of has, like, come together for me, and I wanted to share it with you. So this lesson isn't like the way that we've been thinking about faith this year. It's mostly a lesson about evangelism. It's mostly about sharing the gospel with others. But I'm gonna kind of explain a little bit more as I go along here why I'm talking about what I'm talking about. But I just want everybody to kind of understand that's the context of what I want to talk about this morning. So let's look at John chapter 4 in verse 3, starting in verse 3. This is kind of a lengthy piece of text, so just bear with me as I work through it. John chapter 4 and verse 3, it says, he, that's being Jesus, left Judea and went away again into Galilee, and he had to pass through Samaria. So he came to a city of Samaria called Sychar, near the parcel of ground that Jacob gave his son Joseph. And Jacob's well was there. So Jesus, being wearied from his journey, was sitting thus by the well. It was about the sixth hour. There came a woman of Samaria to draw water, and Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." For his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. Therefore the Samaritan woman said to him, "How is it that you, being a Jew, ask me for a drink, since I am a Samaritan woman? For the Jews have no dealings with Samaritans." Jesus answered and said to her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is who says to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." She said to him, "Sir, you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where then do you get that living water?" I wonder if she did air quotes when she said that, by the way. I don't know. That's what she would have done if it was today. "You are not greater than our father Jacob, are you, who gave us this well and drank of it himself, and his sons and his cattle?" Jesus answered and said to her, "Everyone who drinks of this water will thirst again. But whoever drinks of the water that I will give him shall never thirst. But the water that I will give him will become in him a well of water springing up to eternal life." The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water, so I will not be thirsty nor come all the way here to draw." And he said to her, "Go call your husband and come here." And the woman answered and said, "I have no husband." And Jesus said to her, "You have correctly said, 'I have no husband,' for you have had five husbands, and the one whom you have now is not your husband. This you have said truly." The woman said to him, "Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet." Astute. "Our fathers worshipped in this mountain, and you people say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, believe me, an hour is coming when neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. But an hour is coming, and now is, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For such people the Father seeks to be his worshipers. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth." The woman said to him, "I know the Messiah is coming, he who is called Christ. When that one comes, he will declare all things to us." And Jesus said to her, "I who speak to you am he." What do you think about that story? I mean, what? John's notorious for these weird stories, right? John says at the beginning, you know, "The Word was God. And the Word came and it dwelt among us." And he begins to, from that, that's obviously paraphrasing, he begins from that point early in the book of John to kind of teach us what that means. Now, we all know this. We've studied these concepts before out of the book of John. That John chooses, when he talks about Jesus being the Word, he talks about him as the Logos or Logos. And that, to the Greek reader, would have meant a lot of things, but to kind of summarize it in, you know, in the most simplistic terms, it would have meant that John is claiming that Jesus is the reason for existence, that he is the explanation and the reason for all things. So the big questions in life, right? Like, why are we here? And what is our purpose? What is life about? John sets out early in the book and he says, "Look, I'm going to tell you what life is about. Life is about Jesus. And this Jesus came and he dwelt among us. And let me tell you some stories about him." So one of the things that we learn early on, this is easy, this is the Gospel of John 101, right? When we're reading John, what John is trying to teach us is what life is all about. What is life all about? And seeing that through the lens of Jesus' life and understanding what true meaning and purpose really is. Now, John records all these kind of unique interactions between Jesus and these people. The other gospel writers don't, right? Earlier on, it's the conversation with Nicodemus, and that's a weird conversation, right? This guy comes to him secretly. He's kind of a Jewish brainiac. He kind of knows the law in and out. At least that's what he thinks. And Jesus kind of almost challenges him with this weird, like, riddle. And he's like, "Oh, I don't know." And Jesus rebukes him. And he kind of sends him away, and you see it. You can just sense it. What Jesus is doing is he's saying, Nicodemus, go do some homework. All right? Go figure out what I'm talking about. And we know that Nicodemus does this, because as we kind of watch Nicodemus' story unfold for us or evolve from that point on, he becomes a disciple of Jesus. He becomes a dedicated disciple of Jesus. And we find this story where Jesus interacts with this woman. And, you know, a lot of times we look at this and we classify this, well, I guess we classify it a bunch of different ways. You probably heard 100 different lessons on the Samaritan woman and Jesus' interactions. But as I think about this, one of the ways you can classify this interaction is that it's a series of confrontations. It's a series of conflicts. Now, this is hard when you're reading something. Especially reading kind of discourse, you're reading a conversation that's taking place between two people. There's a lot of nuance that you miss out on, right? You don't really understand the tone that she had. You don't understand the tone that he had. I think we can pick out pretty easily that Jesus is saying some pretty tough things to her. But you know what? She's saying some pretty tough things to Jesus too, as she means them to be, at least it seems. Oftentimes we look at this kind of series of complaints, right? The woman says, you know, you Jews hate us Samaritans. Why are you talking to me? She goes on in verse 12 and she really is claiming what Samaritans like to claim. And that is legitimacy, right? She's saying, our father Jacob, now I don't know if she's saying your and my father Jacob, most likely, but she's putting herself in that. And she's legitimizing herself, right? She's saying, our father Jacob gave us this well, and his sons drank from it. That's the 12 tribes of Israel, right? Of which I'm from. That's what she's claiming, I think. That's kind of the nuance here. And he fed, he watered his cattle from, like, she's, in a sense, trying to give Jesus a history lesson, right? She's saying, look, we're Samaritans are as good as Jews, too, is, I think, kind of the behind the words, kind of meaning in what she's saying, her implications. Then in verse 20, she complains to Jesus about the Jewish kind of stand on where worship should happen. And you can see, you can hear it in her voice, right? You Jews claim, you people claim, you claim that the only place to worship is in Jerusalem. Now, Jesus approaches that, or preaches those subjects later on, right? Well, actually, that is the right thing to do. That is correct. But you can hear it in her voice. Now, I don't know what this sounded like. I don't know if this woman's just kind of like a passive-aggressive, super snarky individual. But I don't think that it sounds like an intellectual conversation between two theologians. I think that Jesus catches this woman off guard from the very beginning. And she is defensive at every turn. Everything that she says is kind of this confrontation. It's got conflict woven into the fabric of her comments. Now, what we typically do with a text like this is we try to make sense of it almost strictly through a historical point of view, almost like I just did, right? We look at it and say, okay, well, what's going on historically with the Jews and Samaritans? You know, why is there all this conflict? How does Jesus deal with that? I'll tell you, as I kind of understand this text now, I think if that's the only way that we look at this text, I think that's important, by the way. I'm not discounting that. But I think if that's the only way that we interpret this text, I think we miss what is actually the point of it. I think there's something far deeper happening here than just two historical worlds colliding, even two religious worlds colliding. I think there's more to see here than just Jesus dealing with a Samaritan woman. Now, I'll point out that when you look at this strictly through a historical lens, isn't it kind of hard to apply? I know I can get up and I can tell you the story, and I can kind of expose all the historical nuances. I can go back and I can show you the conflict. I can show you the origin of the Samaritans. I can show you throughout history the conflict of the Samaritans with the Jews. I can talk about the book of Nehemiah. I can talk about a bunch of stuff, right? I mean, I can do that. And it would help you to maybe make sense of why there's conflict from a historical point of view. Is that why this text is here? I mean, is that what you think? That we're to look at this text and say, okay, we need to get into the history and figure out the history. And the reason that John is telling us this story is because he's concerned with history. You think that's it? Remember, what does John say at the beginning of the book? At the beginning of the book, John says, Jesus is the Logos. And then he is trying to prove it. So how does this go to that? How does Jesus' interaction with this woman help us to understand that Jesus is showing us the true meaning and the true purpose of life, where we actually derive our value from in life? How we begin to build an identity that is an eternal identity, one that has true foundations, one that has true meaning. How does this story relate to that? Here's the thing. I think that ultimately what this teaches us, at least on the surface, is that every evangelistic effort is at its core a conflict. Just think about that for a second. I think that's semi-obvious, right? But the thing that I think we miss maybe sometimes is that the conflict between us and God, as it's kind of played out here between the Samaritan woman and God, Jesus, is also something that echoes in our conflicts with one another. Now, let me kind of move on to the next thought here this way. Here's something that's kind of interesting to me about fighting, about conflict. There's, you know, my mom used to say, me and my sister would get into a fight, and my mom would say, "What is wrong with you guys?" And we both felt like this, right? Like, it was her. And she would go, "It was him." And my mom would look at us and say, "It takes two." I can't remember what she used to say. I don't know if it was tangled, like a dance, is that it? Or tangled. I don't know. I was really afraid of getting hit at that point. So I knew when that was like what happened right before I got in big trouble. So whatever the phrase actually is. And her point in that is what? You both are at fault, right? Like there's a problem with both of you. It's not one of you, it's both of you. Now, my mom in that instance is the third party, right? And my mom would almost always say something like, "Why can't you guys just get along? Like, what? I don't understand what the problem is here. This is not reasonable." And usually she would come in at the third level of retribution. You know what that is, right? Like we talked about with Samson. Like, you took my toy, ate your food, you ate my food, I'm going to destroy your toy, you destroy my toy, I'm going to slap you. You slap me, I'm going to knock you out. And then, when the fists are flying and the dust is moving around, then my mom steps in and she says, what could possibly be so important that you guys are rolling around on the ground acting like animals? It's unreasonable. This is not logical. There's no logical reason for you to be acting that way. Now, here's something about that. I'll say up front, she was right, wasn't she? Because at that point, my sister and I are not reasoning with each other. We're not being logical. That logic is not part of the equation. It's strictly primal at that point, right? It's strictly like, about survival. Because when we're in that situation and someone says, or maybe you're the third party and you say to somebody else, "That's not reasonable. It's not reasonable that you would fight this. It's not reasonable that you would struggle against this." What is almost always the response? It's something like that, right? "You have no idea. You have no idea what this person has done. You have no idea what you're asking of me when you say just be reasonable." Now, I want to tell you something. One of the hardest things about sharing the gospel is that you will look at somebody as you're sharing the gospel with them, which is usually not a couple Bible studies unless that person has really been worked over by God really, really good. And they're just ready for whatever you say. You're just going to say it, and it's going to be the truth, and they're going to be super primed and ready to go. Most of the time, that's not how sharing the gospel works. And so if you go through this process with somebody, and you're trying to help them, you're going to say to yourself, I don't understand. I don't understand what's keeping this person from the Lord. I don't get it. Like, what is reasonably holding them up, right? Now, I think we can look at this story of Jesus and the Samaritan woman, and I think there's a part of me that can look at this and say, guys, at least I can look at this Samaritan woman and be like, really? Like, what? I get it. Okay, Jesus is a Jew, but you just met the guy, right? He's sitting by a well in the middle of the day, beat from traveling, and you're going to take out all of your problems that you have with the Jewish people on this guy who you just met. That's unreasonable, right? That doesn't make any sense. But I'll tell you what, this sounds a lot like conversations I've had where someone will say, I just can't. I can't give myself to God because of what this person who was religious did to me back then. And my mind goes, what does that have to do with God? Right? But that's kind of the same thing. Like, I can stand as a third party and say, well, this doesn't make any sense. This doesn't make any sense. What I'm getting to here is that when we read the story of the Samaritan woman in Jesus, we have to interpret it through a different lens. A lens that actually helps us to understand, first and foremost, what's actually going on. What's actually happening in the mind, in the heart of the Samaritan woman. What happens in the mind and in the heart of all of us, whether it be with God or whether it be with other people. So I want to look at a text that actually I've talked about a couple times in the last couple years that I think will apply directly to the Samaritan woman, that I think will help us. This is a familiar text. In Philippians chapter 2 and verse 3, I've mentioned this before. In Philippians, this is the song of Jesus. Okay? So the way that Philippians is constructed is that in kind of in the middle of the book, Paul offers a song, kind of a hymn about Jesus. And it seems that that's the way that the language is constructed. And that's how we know it. And then all around the song of Jesus are essays about life. And they all look at life with this filter, right? So talk about different relationships, talk about suffering, talk about sacrifice, talk about all different things, but all of them revolve around this truth. And so as Paul's talking about his successes in his past life and how he sees those things as not being important. Well, how, Paul? How is it that you see those things as being a pile of garbage or dung, and you now see the sufferings of Christ as something that's the greatest experience in life? How is it possible that you've gotten yourself to think like that? Well, Paul thinks about those things through this lens. This is his ultimate truth, okay? So that's the context of the song of Jesus. In Philippians 2 and verse 3, this is what Paul says, and part of this is application that's connected to the song. So in verse 3, not part of the song, he says, do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind regard one another as more important than yourselves. Do not, now listen to verse 4, do not merely look out for your own personal interests, but also for the interests of others. I actually think that that's a misinterpreted text or translated text. Have this attitude in yourself, which is also in Christ Jesus, who, although he existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, but he emptied himself, taking on the form of a bondservant and being made in the likeness of men. Being found in the appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. For this reason also, God highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name which is above every name, so that at the name of Jesus, every knee will bow of those who are in heaven and on the earth and under the earth, and that every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. So look at how Paul kind of prefaces, works into the song of Jesus. Because this is our key to understanding why we fight. Why human beings fight. Why we quarrel. Why we fight with each other. Why we fight with God. In this first verse, verse 3, are really the keys. Most of the keys you're going to need to understand people you're trying to help. But I'll say more importantly than that, maybe, at least equally important to that, is the keys to you to understand yourself. I'll say this up front. One of the things that I've learned over the last couple of years, as we as a group have become more evangelistically minded, because we've just grown to that point naturally, and that's the way things are supposed to happen. As that's happened for me again in my life, one of the things that has been reinforced in my convictions is that I can never be for anybody else anywhere near what I'm supposed to be if I'm not being who I'm supposed to be for God. I just can't. I just absolutely cannot. And all those things that Jesus said about, you know, pulling the plank out of your eye before you remove a speck and all those things have kind of rung true with me a little bit deeper than they have in times past. So as we look at this, I want us to think about this two ways. How do we learn how to help people? How do we learn to see people more accurately so that we can help them more skillfully? And then how do we see ourselves as part of that process the way that we ought to, right? So that we can be working on things that we profess to be helping people work on. The first thing he says here is he says, do nothing from selfishness. That's the way the New American Standard translates it. I'll say I think that there's a conduct, there's two conducts here that he's preaching against, but one is core and one is symptomatic. I think this is symptomatic. We'll talk about the core in just a second. But the symptom, he says, is not to do anything from selfishness. The word there is aretheia. It comes from the word, the base of that word comes from the idea of day labor, right? It's closely related. Now, you have to think about that kind of in its historical context to understand its significance. Back in the day, people lived hand to mouth, right? You would, for the most part, if you were in the working class, you went out, you found work, you got paid for that work that day, you went, you bought food for that day, you ate that day. If you did not find work, or if you chose to take the day off, you and everybody in your household also took the day off from eating. That's the way that it worked. And so in an economy like that, you know how this works, right? There is going to be an extraordinary amount, in most cases, an extraordinary amount of competition to get work. And so this idea is there's a spirit of rivalry in this word that is connected to an ambition, but not an ambition to excel, not an ambition to hoard, it's an ambition and a willingness to quarrel in order to survive. It's a very primal thing. The word kind of carries that idea. So imagine what Paul is saying here. He says, do nothing from selfishness. And he borrows this word that the hearers would have understood. Do nothing from this primal desire to survive. Now, obviously, Paul's talking about our spirits, right? Our hearts, our state of mind. What he's doing is he's tapping into how we will develop a spirit of rivalry, and that rivalry will be fueled by this belief that if I don't get what I've set my eyes on, I'm not going to make it, right? I'm going to die. Now, that goes, I think the way that Paul means it goes way beyond food. He means it in the way that we get about life. Do nothing from selfishness. Do nothing from this point of view. Don't have this mindset that if you don't get this thing or this position or this place in life, this respect, this prominence, fill it in blank. Don't think that you're going to die. Don't think that way. You know, a while back, Ed Sanderson came into the meeting and he always talks about this kind of primal existence that we default back to when we're separated from God. And I think that's what Paul is really getting at here, is that when we go back to being like animals, we see all other animals as competition, as taking something away from us that we have to have if we're going to be fill in the blank. And so we develop a spirit of rivalry. We develop a spirit of competition. Let me ask you this. This is going to sound like I'm going off for a second, but just bear with me. How do you relate to others? What I mean by that is, What goes on inside of you that determines how you see other people, how you interact with them, how you talk to them? Here's a couple of options. Our relationships can either be governed by needs or truth. Now, let me even go beyond that. Our needs can be governed by the truth, or truth as we perceive it can be governed by our needs. Think about that for a second. You know what I mean, right? What I mean is I can begin to develop a biblical perspective of the people who are around me if I will subject myself to God's truth as openers, right? If I look at God's truth as ultimate, then I begin to see people the way that God does. And then my needs follow suit. In other words, the way this works in Christianity is I become a Christian, and very soon after, God begins to educate me as to what I actually need. Before, as a Christian, I believed that I needed a lot of things. That what I find out when I become a Christian is I don't need them at all. I thought I needed those things because those things built my identity in this world. Those things were my foundations that I was building a structure on that was DJ. But when I came to Christ, what Christ and his truth began to teach me is that I don't actually need those things. So truth was molding my understanding of my needs. But here's what we do as people a lot of times, right? Is we actually mold the truth by our needs. Do you understand the difference? What that means is when I read the truth, what I'm doing is I'm saying I have to fit the truth into this shape container that is my needs. I have to make this work with what I've already determined are my needs. I want you to understand that when we do that, when our needs govern truth, we're going to have fighting. We're going to have conflict. It's the way that works. Because our needs are the most important thing that exists. When your needs govern the truth, you become a fighter. When the truth governs your needs, you actually find real quickly you begin to have very functional relationships, both with God and with others. Now think about that spirit of rivalry in the Samaritan woman. You see it? You see it, right? She says a bunch of things that are not true at all, but who are they true to? Who are they true to? They're true to her, right? She has all of these perspectives that are not actually accurate that Jesus has to correct her on, but those are true to her. She has a spirit of rivalry with Jesus because what we do when we live this way, when our needs dictate truth or govern truth, we make everything personal. Do you sense that from the Samaritan woman? Like, most of what she says is in the context of you Jews and us Samaritans, but do you really think that she's, like, wrestling with, like, kind of these world problems? Like, just an advocate for people that aren't her? I don't think so. I think that the problems that she presents to Jesus are the things that she's got a beef about. This is about her. Everything is personal. This is what happens, guys. Listen. When you're sitting down with somebody, now, don't put this on the internet, because I'm actually in the middle of studying with this person. I don't want them to hear that they listen to these lessons. I study with a person that at the end of every one of our studies proceeds to tell everybody in that study how successful her children are. She takes everything that we talk about, and she makes it about her. And she makes it about her successes. We've been studying with this individual for a long time. And it's like every study, like without exception, she starts talking about how great her kids are, which in essence she's saying how great she is, which is her kind of making everything about her. Like she's begun to center everything on her. And when you are that kind of a person, what you end up doing is you end up getting deeply offended about everything. You can't be objective about anything. Everything is about you. So when people don't like your kids, can you imagine this woman? If People don't like her kids, what kind of person she turns into? I know. We've seen these people. We have been these people. This is so key for us. And if you're doing this, if you're allowing your needs to dictate truth, and thereby you're becoming kind of like this person who makes everything about themselves, I just want to tell you, you can't help other people. You can't in that condition. You have to be willing to allow God's truth to tell you your needs are off. And your foundations are in this world. And they're not in the things of God. And until you can have that honesty, then not only are you lost, but everybody that you think you're helping, you're going to affect in a way that potentially endangers them. So the second thing, that's actually just symptomatic. I think that's just kind of a symptom. But the core issue is in the next word. The next thing he says is, do nothing from empty conceit. I've talked about this recently. You're going to remember this when I start talking about it. The idea of empty conceit, the King James Version, I think, has actually got this one wrapped up pretty well. The King James Version says, do nothing from vain glory. The word there is kenodoxia. Doxai is the word for glory. Glory, we've talked about recently, carries the idea of weightiness. Also, you kind of carry that to the next degree, it means importance. The idea of glory is, it is the thing that makes us worth something. The word kenodoxia means, essentially, glory hungry. Do nothing from a place of being glory hungry, is what Paul is telling them. Now, where does glory hunger come from? Where does that come from? It comes from a fear, ultimately, of being insignificant. Do you fear that? Do you fear being insignificant? I don't know. Do you fear ideas presented to you about you being temporary? Do you worry and fear being an outsider? I don't know if there's any of us that here that could honestly say, no, I don't worry about that stuff at all, right? Because then you would have this master. If you got this master, I guess I'm not talking to you. But I tend to think all of us worry about that. Now, you may hear those words and think, oh, I don't have a problem with that. I don't have a problem with being insignificant. Just look at me, I'm pretty insignificant. I don't have a problem with being temporary. I don't care about legacy. I don't care about my name sticking around. I don't care about being marginalized. I mean, you start saying those things, and if you're halfway honest, you start realizing, actually, I do care about those things. When you fear being any of those, then you begin to develop an appetite for glory, right? What do you typically do when someone makes you feel small or attempts to make you feel small? What's your reaction to that? Is your reaction, yeah, I am pretty small? Maybe that's your bit. I mean, maybe, you know, some people have that bit, right? Because they know that punching the person is not acceptable behavior or screaming at them or losing their minds over it. But most of us, when someone tries to make us small, when someone tries to marginalize us, when someone tries to tell us that what we're doing is worthless and it's not going to last and it's not going to have any impact on anybody, we begin to kind of lose our minds over it. Now, whether we show that on the outside or not, I don't know. But most of us, this is the kind of stuff that we lose sleep over. When people begin to do this to us, or we begin to sense this, we become afraid of that, and we develop a hunger for something that will change the course of our life and make it not so. You know, I've come to realize about myself the worst thing that someone can do to me, often the way that I perceive it, this is not in actuality, but the way that I exist oftentimes, the worst thing that someone can do to me is not disagree with me, but it's to marginalize me. Now, sometimes I feel like people, when they're disagreeing with me, are marginalizing me, and I lost my mind. But I'm not losing my mind over the fact that we can't agree on something. What I'm losing my mind over is that you're making me feel small. And so I go berserko over it. I lash out. And there's a bunch of, there's a whole series of discussions about the ways, the nuances, the subtleties, and how we lash out aggressively, passive aggressively, internally, externally. I mean, there's a thousand things we can talk about with that. But the point is, look inside yourself and think about how you really react when someone gets to you and convinces you that you're not important. You know, the Bible teaches us that sin and idolatry are an attempt at gaining value without God's presence, right? That's lesson number one in the book of Genesis. Satan says to Eve, you can have value and meaning. As a matter of fact, without God, your value and meaning is going to be what? Greater, right? It's going to be exponentially greater. But what we end up with is vain existence. Do you see it? That's why the King James Version, I think, ropes this one pretty well. Do nothing from vainglory. Vainglory is the attempt to circumvent the existence of God and find somehow meaning and purpose, and to put ourselves in the center of things as key, as important, as necessary, as essential. But when we do that, what we find is some what the Bible calls vanity. It's like trying to grab vapor. It's like trying to rustle smoke. You can't do it. It's elusive. It always gets away from you. And so you find yourself, like we've talked about recently with our lessons in idolatry, you find yourself telling yourself things like, oh, I still believe that's the method, the right method, but I just had the wrong subject, right? Maybe it wasn't in that pursuit. Maybe it wasn't in my education, but it is in my job. Maybe it's not in my job, but it is in my family. Maybe it's not in my family, but it is in this item of wealth. Well, maybe it's not in this item of wealth. Maybe it's just going to be in being the greatest volunteer that ever ever happened? That's not right. Ever existed. And then you find that that's vain and empty. Think about how the Samaritan woman displays these tendencies. Think about her relationship with men. Did you find it odd that right after Jesus said what he said about living water, he looks at her and he says, go find your husband. I've heard a bunch of explanations about that as far as being cultural. It's not cultural. It's obvious what Jesus is doing. Jesus is saying, go get your husband. She goes, well, sure, you know, since we're being honest here, I don't have a husband. And Jesus says, I know you don't have a husband. You know what? You've had a flock. And now the one you have isn't even a husband. I guess is how you interpret that. Or maybe he's saying something more theological there. I don't know. But point being, you've tried to find meaning over and over and over and over and then. And where has it landed you, Samaritan woman? It's landed you out here by this well in the middle of the day, disgraced even from the Samaritans, disgruntled about all of the injustices that have been done to you by the Jews, when in reality, most of the plight in your life has probably been brought on by your own behavior, right? That's what's going on. Jesus is pointing out to her, you have tried to fill yourself over and over and over again with the things that cannot fill you. Your problem is not with the Jews. Your problem is with vainglory. That's your problem. And so Paul tells us, those who are striving to be like Christ, do nothing from selfishness or vainglory because it doesn't fill. And how can we see it in others if we're caught in the same exercise ourselves? How can we diagnose that in them? Well, how do we stop? What's the prognosis in this text? I think it's simple. I don't think it's all that complicated. Both in Philippians and in John chapter 4, we have to understand that we behave like this because of sin. Again, the Bible teaches us that all sin is based in what? Self. All sin is based in self. Even well-intentioned sin is based in self. It's selfishness. What happens the more you demand things be done your way? You ever thought about that? Fran and I were talking about this a while back. I've been thinking about this for a long time. That was like a month ago.
What happens? If you're the kind of person that always demands your way, always talks about your issues, always centers everything on yourself, what happens? Now, you may not realize this has happened to you. Typically, what happens is people that do this further their dysfunction by becoming to even more play the role of the victim. So I'm just going to tell you, if what has happened to you is you don't have anybody in your life, I don't know what the circumstances are, first of all, and I don't pretend to know. But I would encourage you to take a really honest look at yourself and see whether or not you've made everything about you. Because if you've made everything about you, if everything is about your issues, everything's about your circumstances, everything's about your feelings, everything's about your wants, guess what's going to happen after a while? You get super boring to everybody who's around you. And you know what happens to boring people? They get left. And so before you know it, you look up to complain about something, and there's no one there to listen to you. And if you're not careful, what you do at that point is you say, oh, everybody's deserted me. Yep, that's true. Everybody deserted you. You know why? Because you're literally like the most boring person that ever existed. Because it's super difficult to find anything interesting or worthwhile in an individual that makes everything about themselves. That's the truth. I'm sorry. If you're one of these people, I'm sorry. And I don't mean to be insensitive about it, but this is it. That's how that works. You know, here's your fix. Your fix isn't the people in your life getting on board with the way you see yourself. As a matter of fact, the more people you can manipulate to see you the way that you see you, the more unhealthy your life's going to be. You know that. You know that. The fix is to realize that your problem is a sin problem. It's the same problem that every single person in this room has, every single person on this planet has. And that problem is neglecting the truth that when God made us, He made us in His image. And for that moment of time, we had actual glory. That glory went away the moment we decided to start doing things our way. Kind of what is so great about children, isn't it? Like babies. I think, and not to be too sappy here, but I think when you look at a baby, what you see in that baby is a glimmer of what we once were. A human being made in the image of God. And we marvel at it. You ever notice when you put a baby in the middle of the room what every adult in the room does? It's stupid, but it's not. It's wonderful at the same time. I feel foolish doing it, but we all do it. You know, they bring Isla into the middle of the room and set her down. She used to be deadly, but now she's like running around acting crazy. Put Isla in the middle of the room. Everybody in the room stops watching the Padre meme and starts looking at Isla. Look at her. Just so you guys know, it's not going to last. Sure, you wish it would, but it's not going to. What has happened is because of sin, the glory of God has been stripped away from us. And so what sin is an attempt to get it back. It's an attempt to be what I think we all know we once were. But it's the wrong way of doing it. You know, at the very least, what we have to see at this point in the conversation, which is the end of the conversation, really, is that that's not something that can be got by us. It's not something that we can achieve. You realize that, right? Even in the replacement of moralities, we can achieve the glory that was once given to us. Even when we replace our old moral system for Christ's new moral system, we can achieve that glory. Not completely. It's something ultimately that has to be given to us. Now, you may be saying, I don't really understand what you're talking about. Good. Neither do I entirely. But let me explain to you or remind you what is said in the Song of Jesus. What is said in the Song of Jesus is that Jesus left the glory of heaven and took on the form of a man. Now, he never sinned, so he kept that glory. But did you notice
that in his subjective service to the Father and dying on the cross, that at the end, God bestows on him a greater glory? Did you notice that? Than he had when he walked among us?
Jesus is our forerunner, and what he's telling us is that we can't achieve that glory on our own. It has to be given to us the way that it was given to Jesus. Now, do you remember what Jesus offered that woman? You remember? What's the offer at the well? Living water. Isn't that interesting? That what Jesus sees in this woman who spent her life, at least recently, disgraced because of her attempts to be glory-filled by the things of this world that are temporary and not permanent. What Jesus offers this woman is satisfaction that never goes away. Isn't that it? He says to her, if you knew the gift of God and who it is who says to you, give me a drink, you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water. Think about this as we wrap up and begin to think about our invitation. Isaiah 55 starts this way. Ho, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters, and you who have no money, come buy and eat. Come buy wine and milk without money and without cost. The idea here isn't like, if you have no money, that's fine, but if you have money, we're going to take it at the door. The point is, money can't buy what's being offered, right? In other words, you can't get this through an exchange that is, I'm providing something that you now owe me goods or services. This is not a commercial exchange that's being talked about. What is being offered is something that you cannot buy. It's something you cannot earn. It's something you cannot get in this world through your own achievements. You cannot do it. It's impossible. But God offers it to you freely. And so God asks you this morning the question of verse number 2. Why do you spend money for what is not bread, and your wages for what does not satisfy? Listen carefully to me and eat what is good and delight yourself in, I'll add my own word there, true abundance. What is true? This is what Jesus has offered all of us. Every single person that you'll ever sit down across the table from and open God's word with has got this problem. You have to see it. If you don't see it, you can't help it. But I'll tell you what, if you don't see it in you, and God hasn't helped you, and he isn't making you glorious because he's living in you and you are ceasing to exist, as Paul encourages the Philippian Christians, have this attitude. What's the attitude? The attitude of death. Die. Die. Give it up. Stop trying to buy what cannot satisfy. Stop it. And give yourself to the Lord and allow him to fill you with what is actually glorious. And that is his son. If that's not the life you're living, then you're not living the right life. No matter what you've told yourself, no matter what you've told the people in your life, whatever story you've sold, if this is not it, it's the wrong story. And the worst thing of it all is not only will you be grossly disappointed in the day of judgment when Jesus looks at you and says what he has to say, and that is, depart from me, I don't know you. And we say, well, that is so mean. Although you do it to boring people, and people do it to you when you're being boring and being selfish. And that's all Jesus is going to do is acknowledge the truth that you've lived a selfish existence, if that's actually your fate, if that's what you choose. And you're not of him. You're not of his glory. You're of your own glory. Not only are you going to be grossly disappointed, but so will all the people that you've sold your story to as being the story. So I'd encourage you not to do that. If you are thirsty, then come. If you're hungry, then come. And be filled with the glory of God and stop working your life to buy things and fill yourself with things that you know can't satisfy.
The problem isn't that you haven't picked the right thing to buy. The problem is you're in the totally wrong economy. The only economy that brings glory and meaning and purpose and value to our life is the upside down economy of Jesus Christ, in which you come and die because he's died for you, and you continue to die so that he can live within you. That's the only economy that actually is and will go forever. If you're ready to give yourself to that this morning, let us know how we can help you, how we can serve you, how we can open God's word with you and share it with you in a way that will inspire you to give it up. Give up the nonsense that you've been engaged in that you know is not a fruitful life. Let us know how we can serve you the way that Jesus has served us. Let's see how we stand and sing our invitation song.